We're beginning here with the Mishnah on the top of Lamed Aleph, Lamed Aleph. The Mishnah here is continuing, similar to the Mishnayot that we did on yesterday's daf, to discuss what's really meant by a terminology, Bilashon B'nei Adam, which is that when you use this terminology, even though you might have considerations to include or exclude certain parties, the Gemara concluded yesterday, and we're going to see later on in the Masechta, Umid Nidarim Aleich Achar Lashon B'nei Adam. When it comes to Nidarim, it goes after what the vernacular or after what people normally would use in these circumstances. Therefore, when you use the terminology, the Gemara here is trying to define for us that terminology, what it meant to people at that time, or what would have been the overwhelming understanding of such a terminology. So a person who says, Anoder Mishuftei Shabbat, someone who takes a neder not to get Hana'ah from those that are Shomer Shabbat, Asur B'Yisrael V'Asur B'Kutim. Not only is he restricted to get benefit from Yisrael, he's also restricted from getting benefit from the Kutim. Now, the Kutim, it's a machloket amongst the Tanaim that later persists into the time of the Amoraim as to whether Kutim are Geri Emet or Kutim are Geri Arayot. And here, the Mishnah seems to take in the position that they are Geri Emet, that they're considered to be true blue converted Jews. And therefore, they have the same status as a Jew here with regards to Shmirat Shabbat. So, if the person says about Shoftei Shabbat that he's going to restrict himself and those that keep the Shabbat, the assumption being that that includes anybody who is Israel, as well as anybody else who is a Kuti. In general, when it comes to the mitzvot, we assume that mitzvot that the Kutim kept, they kept better than Bnei Yisrael themselves. Now, there were certain mitzvot that they did not keep, or they were not so enamored with. In those instances, they did not keep the mitzvot. With regards to Shabbat, the assumption is that the Kutim did keep the Shabbat. Me'ochle shum, from those that consume garlic, asur b'Yisrael v'asur b'Kutim. Then he's restricted again from Klal Yisrael, as well as the Kutim. Now, as Rashi points out over here, what is shum relevant to Klal Yisrael? Because me'ochle shum b'lele Shabbat, that eat garlic on Friday night, and as Tosafot, Aran point out that it was a Takanat Ezra, that they eat garlic on Friday night, because that was the night of Onah, which is Shemekaimim, Erev Shabbat, Erev Shabbat, that on a weekly basis, a person keeps the Onah with his wife, Umar Belahem Hazera, and Shum was considered to increase the Zera of the individual, we'll call it some form of aphrodisiac, that was utilized, and therefore Friday night, which was the Zman HaOnah, was appropriate to eat garlic, and therefore Jews were known to consume large amounts of garlic, especially on Friday night, and this was a well-known thing, and therefore if a person says Mochle Hashum, that was something that was associated with Jews and with the Kutim. What's interesting over here is that we're talking about a Takanat Ezra, which in general the Kutim, if they did keep something, they usually kept things that were generally found in the Torah Shebichtav, and generally things that were not takanot or additions of the Nevi'im or the Rabbanan. The fact that they kept a Takanat Ezra is very interesting in of itself. The fact that they were makpid to eat the shum on Friday night, even though this is not a Din HaTorah or something that's found in the Torah. Mo'olei Yerushalayim, from those that go up to Yerushalayim, Asur b'Yisrael u'mutar b'Kutim. Then he's restricted in Israel because Bnei Israel go up to Yerushalayim, meaning that's the center of their worship. On the other hand, the Kutim don't do that. Shehem einam yolim Yerushalayim el har grizim. They considered har grizim to be their holy location, their holy place, and even till today, the Shomronim believe that har grizim is considered to be the center of their worship, the holy mountain. And we know that later on, after a certain point of this argument persisting as to whether the Kutim were considered to be Geri Emet or Geri Ayot, that they went and checked and they found that they had some sort of form of Avodah Zarah up on Har Grizim that they were worshiping, and at that point they declared the Kutim to be non-Jews or not considered to be Geri Emet. But we know that the Kutim have the focus of their worship around Har Grizim and not around Yerushalayim. So now the Gemara wants to clarify how we defined each of these terms here. Gemara says, "My Shoftei Shabbat." What does it mean, someone who is Shomer Shabbat? Ilema Mimikaime Shabbat. If you're talking about people who keep the Shabbat, who are Shomer Shabbat, My yiriya bikutim. Then why are you limiting it to kutim? Afilu ovdei kochavim nami. There are also non-Jews who keep the Shabbat. Maybe you're talking about the Seventh-day Adventists. There are people who keep Shabbat and they desist from doing melacha on Shabbat. So why are you limiting it to Jews and kutim? Why aren't ovdei kochavim included as well? Ela mimitzuvim ala Shabbat. Must be that the Mishnah is referencing those that are commanded to keep the Shabbat. So that would include Jews and that would include kutim. It says, ihachi ema seifa. Then what are you going to do with the last line in the Mishnah? The last line in the Mishnah says that me'olei Yerushalayim, from those that go up to Yerushalayim, asur b'Yisrael mutar b'kutim. That means you're restricted with regards to Israel, mutar b'kutim, am I? V'ha mitzuvim ninhu. If you're saying that the Mishnah, when it uses a terminology here, it's talking about those that are commanded in such a mitzvah, then even though the kutim may not keep the mitzvah, they are commanded to go up to Yerushalayim. So Bnei Yisrael and the Kutim are equally commanded to be Ole the Yerushalayim. If that's the case, then you should be Asur not only Yisrael, you should also be Asur be Kutim. So Abaye solves the problem and says, Amar Abaye, Mitzuveh Vo'oseh Ktani. Our mission is talking about those that are commanded, but not only commanded, but they keep the command that is demanded of them. So B'tarte Bave Kamaito, when we're talking about the first two instances in our Mishnah, which is Shoftei Shabbat, and Ochle Shum, Yisrael v'kutim mitzuvim, they're both commanded, v'osim, and they are mikayim. They uphold the command that is demanded of them. Ovdei kochavim, halu da'avdei, those that do it, osim ve'ena mitzuvim. They do it, but they're not commanding it. It's a person who's osev ve'ena mitzuveh. Person who does it, but he is not commanded to keep that such a mitzvah. So even though they might be shoftei Shabbat, maybe even there are Ochle Shum, but they're not doing it under the framework of being commanded to do it. They're simply doing it voluntarily. Ba'ole Yerushalayim, when it comes to being going up to Yerushalayim, Yisrael mitzuvim ve'osim. Bnei Yisrael are commanded to do it, and they uphold that commandment. Kutim mitzuvim ve'enan osim. They are commanded to do it, you are correct, but they are not mikayim. They do not keep that mitzvah being ole Yerushalayim. They replaced Yerushalayim with Har Gerizim. And then because of that, they are excluded from the terminology of Ole Yerushalayim, even though they are mitzuveh, but they're mitzuveh ve'ein oseh. Okay, the next Mishnah is a case where a person says, Konam, she'eni ne'neh livnei Noach, mutar b'Yisrael, basur ba'ovdei kochavim. A person says that I will not get any benefit from a ben Noach. He is allowed to get benefit from Israel, but he's not allowed to get benefit from a non-Jew. The question the Gemara asks, V'Yisrael minofik michalal b'nei Noach. When you say b'nei Noach are everybody in the world. After the Mabul, the only survivor of the Mabul is Noach and his family. That means that anybody who exists in the world today is a descendant of Noach. So why are Israel excluded from the terminology b'nei Noach? B'nei Noach is the equivalent of saying b'nei Adam. When we talk about b'nei Adam, we mean humankind, anybody who's a human being. Why? Because everybody descends from Adam. Well, the same is true with regards to Noach. Post the Mabul, everybody descends from Noach, and therefore, if you use the terminology B'nai Noach, why aren't Israel included under that term? Gemara says, Kevin the Kaddish Avram itkaru al Shemei. From the time period where Avraham was chosen by God and designated to be the heir of the chosen nation, then B'nai Israel are called by the name Avraham Avinu, so we're considered to be B'nai Avraham. Whereas the remainder of the world is known as B'nai Noach. So B'nai Abraham distinguishes us or singles us out in distinction from B'nai Noach. And we're no longer known as B'nai Noach. We're now known as B'nai Abraham. Not to say we aren't B'nai Noach, but when person uses the terminology Ben Noach, it's clear that he's not referring to a Jew, but rather to a non-Jew. And that's what we have the terminology Shiva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. Talking about the Shiva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, we're talking about the seven mitzvot that everybody is commanded in. But still in that sense, we're not talking about Jews. We're talking about non-Jews, even though Jews are Ben Noach. Now it is true that the Gemara in Sanhedrin discusses this question as to whether, when it comes to the mitzvot B'nai Noach, are B'nai Yisrael commanded in the Shiva Mitzvot B'nai Noach? Meaning, are the 613 mitzvot really the Shiva Mitzvot B'nai Noach plus another 606? Or are the 613 mitzvot displacing completely the Sheva mitzvot B'nai Noach? So, are B'nai Yisrael really a Ben Noach plus, or are Bnei Yisrael a completely new entity? But in either instance, the Gemara is saying here, at least with regards to the terminology or the vernacular, when someone uses the term Ben Noach, they mean it anyone excluding a Ben Avraham, anyone excluding a Jew. And since it's excluding a Jew, if a person says, I will not get Hana'ah from a Ben Noach, that means that he's not meaning to exclude from his opportunity to get benefit a Yisrael. He's only excluding people who are Ovdei Kochavim. Sheini Ne'aneh L'Zera Avraham. I will not get any benefit from the offspring of Avraham. Asur b'Yisrael umutar b'Ovdei Kochavim. Then he's restricted with regards to any Jew, but he's mutar with regards to any non-Jew. Gemara asks the obvious question, which is that even out of the descendants of Avraham, they're not solely Jews. Avraham has Yitzchak and Yishmael, and then Yitzchak himself has Yaakov and Esav. So if I look at that subdivision, that means even under the category of Avraham, leaving aside even the Bnei Pelileg Shim that were born to Avraham, but simply even those that are children, that are full children of Avraham Avinu, you still have Ishmael, and you also have Esav as being a descendant. So how come when a person says Zera Avraham, a descendant of Avraham, he's only referring to Klal Yisrael, and he's not referring to anyone besides that? Where it says, Vayika Ishmael, who is a son of Avraham Avinu, ki b'Yitzchak ikara lecha Zara. So this is the pasuk that's quoted by Chazal, that tells us that ki b'Yitzchak ikara lecha Zara k'tiv, that it says that Yitzchak is the primary bearer of the name of Avraham Avinu, and therefore the only one who's really considered to be the Zera of Avraham, or the true inheritor of the mantle of Avraham, is Yitzchak. Where it says, okay, that's fine, but Vayika Esav, if you say Yitzchak is the mantle carrier, he still has two children, Yaakov and Esav. So why isn't Esav subsumed under Zera Avraham? So he quotes the Chazal again, ki bi Yitzchak ikara the Chazara, bi Yitzchak is a limiter, or has a qualifying statement, which means, v'lo kol Yitzchak. Bi Yitzchak means a portion of Yitzchak will carry the mantle, but not all of Yitzchak. And therefore, only Yaakov is the inheritor of the mantle from Yitzchak, Esav is not. And therefore, only of the descendants of Avraham is it Yitzchak, and then Yaakov are considered to be Zera Avraham. And that's why when you take a neder, not to get hana from Zera Avraham, you're only including Bnei Yisrael, and not Bnei Yishmael, and not Bnei Esav. And Gerim would be included here too, as well as being Bnei Avraham. It goes to a famous Rabbeinu Tam that is mentioned in the Gemara in Baba Batra with regards to Bikurim, as to whether a ger can say in Shmon Esra, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. And even more famous is the letter of the Rambam to Ovadia Ger, where he tells him that you're allowed to say Elokeinu, Elokei Avoteinu when he davens, because you are considered to be the descendant of our forefathers, descendants of Avraham Avinu, even though technically you're not a direct descendant of Avraham Avinu because you're a ger, but you converted. But once you come tachet kanfei Ashchina, then you are like a child of Avraham Avinu, ki av hamon goyim nitaticha, that Hashem made Avraham into the father of all the nations. And therefore the goyim are also considered to be the offspring of Avraham. Right, now the next Mishnah continues and says, she'eni ne'ne Yisrael, that a person says, I will not get any benefit from Klal Yisrael, lokeach biyoter, umocher b'chapachot. He has to buy at a higher price than market, and he has to sell at less than market price. So if he has commerce or interactions, business interactions with another Jew, how does he prevent himself from getting benefit from Yisrael? Well, he pays more than he should in terms of purchasing. That way he's sure he got no benefit from that individual because he overpaid for it. And then if he's selling it, he undersells the price. So he's sure again that he got no benefit from the purchaser who is Yisrael from him. So that's how he can ensure that he gets no benefit from them when it comes to transactions between him and the Yisrael. As the Ran points out over here, this is only true when the nether was taken as an Iser Hana'ah. On the other hand, if the nether was taken to be Oser Nichsehem, the possessions of Israel, that wouldn't matter. None of this would help, because then your statement is, I don't want to get any benefit from any possession of Israel. Well, there's no benefit or there's no possession of Israel. It doesn't matter if you overcharge or you undercharge. You can't get benefit from them whatsoever. So in that case, none of this would work. It's only working over here because of the fact that he said, neheneh, that I won't get benefit from them. This way, by transacting in such a manner, he can prevent there being benefit from Israel. On the other hand, if the nether is taken the other way around, Israel nehenehemli, he restricts other Jews from getting benefit from him, then lokeach bepachot, he has to buy at a discount, umocher biyoter, and he has to sell at a premium. He has good luck to him to get the party on the other side to agree to this, but basically he is going to sell things above market, and he's going to purchase things below market in order to ensure that the opposing party is getting no benefit from him in the transaction. Ve'ein shomim lo. And of course, nobody's going to listen to him. Nobody's going to agree to such a thing, because who's going to agree to give this guy the advantage just so that he can take care of his nether? The Ran notes that there might be an alternative girsa over here, which is not ein shomim lo, that nobody's going to listen to him, but rather im or in shomim lo, if they do listen to him, if someone's willing to lose their money to help this guy out, then he'll be able to do this. Otherwise, he won't be able to do it. And the Ran points out over here, even though we believe dapagav dekaimelan deinan dam oser davar shelo bali olam, that individuals unable to be oser something that has yet to exist, an object that has yet to come into the world, nevertheless, when it's talking about hana'ah, which in a sense is an intangible object that is connected to the person themselves, that is something that is bali olam, because the individual is here now, and hana'ah is generated or felt by that individual, and therefore it's no longer deemed to be a davar shelo bali olam. He's not specifying an object which is yet to be here and will be here in the future. Rather, he's specifying the hana'ah that derives from this specific individual, and that specific individual is present now, and therefore it's not deemed to be a davar shelo bali olam. She'eni nelehem v'hein li. If he takes the neder in such a manner where it prevents mutual benefit, he cannot get a benefit from Jews, and Jews can't get benefit from him, then yeheneh lo'ovdei kochavim. His only option left at that point is to interact or transact with non-Jews. You might have thought that if the transaction went at market price, that maybe there's no benefit to either party. It's at the market price, and therefore there's no benefit to the buyer, there's no benefit to the seller. Along comes the Mishnah to tell you that it's not the case, but rather he has to interact with other parties that are not Israel in order for him to transact. And it's not good enough that he's transacting at the, call it, market neutral price in order to have it that he's not benefiting from the seller and the buyer is not benefiting from him. The Ran brings from the Ra'azal that the Chiddush here is that HaKash Mashmalan Lo Tema given the Hochi Nadar Yevshol La'amod B'Nidron. You would have maybe thought that he can't uphold this nether. It's impossible for him to live and not have these interactions or transactions with the Jews. And therefore, it would be deemed to be basically a nether levatala. And since it's a nether levatala, it would automatically be nullified, and then he could go ahead and get hana from Israel, equivalent to what we saw earlier in the Masechta, that a person says, shvua shlo ishan, a person says the shvua that he will not sleep. Then, since it's impossible for him to uphold that shvua, therefore, we deem it to be a shvua levatala immediately. We give him a code for that and tell him to go to sleep right away. So maybe over here too, we should say that it's a neder levatala because he won't be able to uphold this neder. The Mishnah comes to teach you, no, that he has a way to deal with it, is yehaneh lovdei kochavim. He has to deal with non-Jews, and there is a way for him to uphold the neder, and therefore it's not considered or deemed to be a neder levatala. So Amar Shmuel, alokeach kli min ha'uman levakro. Ve'ne'enas biyado chayav. A person who takes an object, a utensil, from the craftsman, levakro, to check it out. He's taking it for a test drive, and something happens while he's in possession of the object, chayav. He is responsible for the object. So, for instance, you go to the car dealer, and you want to test out the car that they're selling. So, you sign the form that you're going to take out the car in order to test drive it. Then, if something happens to the car during that test drive, who's responsible for that car? So here, the Shmuel says that the person who's taking out for the test drive is fully responsible for the car while he's taking the test drive. Now, Alma, Kasavar, Hanat Lokeachi. What you see from Shmuel is that the beneficiary of the test drive is the buyer. You could have argued that the seller is also a beneficiary of the test drive because if the buyer is happy with it, he's going to end up buying it. So the seller is also a beneficiary. Shmuel's statement says that the hana'ah clearly belongs to the buyer in the test drive, and therefore he becomes the responsible party when it comes to anything that happens during that test drive or the trial period in which he's using the object. As the Ron points out over here, that this statement of Shmuel is qualified by the fact that they've already set the price. Since they've already set the price, the only question is whether the buyer wants to buy it or doesn't want to buy it. So at this point, kol hana'ah shelo, all the benefit is accruing to him because the negotiation over price has already been completed. So the only question now is whether the buyer decides to take it or not. Therefore, when he takes it on a test drive or he utilizes it to see if he wants it, then he's the sole beneficiary. In a case where the price has yet to be set, then the seller is also a beneficiary in the test drive because he could then demand more money because the buyer now sees how good his object is or sees how wonderful it is. And therefore, it may not be that kol hana'ah is the lokeach in that case. And that's why the Ran says over here that ukmina and in baba batra, that bikitze demea. It's a case here where the object is clear what the value is, or they've already agreed on price, and that's why kol hana'ah is to the lokeach. Tznan, our Mishnah. She'eni nehne miYisrael, or she'eni nehne liYisrael, that I will get no benefit from any Jew. Mocher bepachot, he has to sell below market. Aval shaveh b'shaveh, lo. He can't sell at market neutral price. V'hi anat lokeachi. If really, truthfully, the benefit is to the buyer, afilu shaveh b'shaveh, then even at equal transaction, market neutral price, if the beneficiary is the buyer, then why should it have to do with him selling it b'pachot? If you believe like Shmuel, that the lokeach is the beneficiary of a purchase, then why can't he sell it at market neutral price? Because if he's the seller, and he said, I won't get hana from Yisrael, Yisrael is the buyer over here. And if the buyer is the beneficiary in a market neutral transaction, then what benefit did he get? He actually got no benefits, lokeach's benefits, so why shouldn't it be permissible? Gemara says, matnitan bizvina derami alape. Our Mishnah is talking about a case where it's a piece of merchandise which is difficult to sell. It's not easy to find buyers for the object. So in that instance, the seller is also a beneficiary. He's been looking for a bid for a long time on the object. Finally, somebody shows up who's willing to buy it. So in that case, we're going to say, wait a minute, the beneficiary here is not the lokeach because this guy's having a hard time selling it. So you know who the real beneficiary in this case is? The seller. So therefore, even at a shaveh b'shaveh, normally we would say the buyer is the beneficiary in that case. In our instance, because it's merchandise that has been on the shelf for a long time, it's inventory that he's trying to clear out, he finally gets someone who's willing to buy it, then it's to the seller's benefit. Gemara says, Im kain, emaresha. Wait a minute, what about the other instance then? Lokeach biyoter. In the case where he said, I will not get hana from Yisrael, it says that he has to buy at a premium price. Well, why does he have to buy at a premium price? If we're talking about a object, a utensil, inventory that's hard to move, then the seller is getting benefit even if he pays market neutral, if he pays the market price for the object. He doesn't have to buy it at a premium in order to make sure that the beneficiary here is the seller and not the buyer. If he bought it just at the market price, the seller would also be the beneficiary in this case because it's something that he's been trying to unload for a long time. Ve'od, ema seifa. What are you going to do with the latter half? I mean, the second half of the Mishnah, which is Yisrael ne'enim li. In a case where he says that B'nai Yisrael cannot get hana from him, lokeach bipachot, then he has to buy at a discount, umocher biyoter, and he sells at a premium. Ve'i bizvino derami alapei. If we're talking about difficult to move merchandise, afilu sheveh b'sheveh, then even at equal level at market price, it should be fine. In a case where he sells it at a market price, then the Israel is not getting any benefit from him because he was having a hard time moving it, and the real beneficiary is him, not the buyer over here. So Gemara says, well, we'll have to split up the Mishnah. Seifa bezvina charifa. The seifa of the Mishnah is talking about a case where it's a hot item. It's merchandise that moves itself. He doesn't even have to sell it. It walks off the shelf by itself. So in that case, it's clear that the buyer is the beneficiary because he got his hands on some inventory like this. Where it says, Iochi lokeach bipachot. If that's the case, then why does the Israel have to buy at a discount in order that it will be clear that he's not getting benefit from this individual? Afilu shaveh b'shaveh. Even if he buys it at the market price, it's clear that the buyer is the beneficiary over here. Ella matnitin, you have to say with regards to our Mishnah, bizvina mitzah. Our Mishnah is talking about normal merchandise, not merchandise that's really hot and that walks off the shelf by itself, not merchandise that's been on the shelf for a long time and he just wants to get rid of it, so therefore he's willing to move it at any price, but rather just regular type of merchandise. Since it's regular type of merchandise, it has to err on the side of making sure that there is no hana in the transaction. So that has to be either done by discounting or premium pricing in order to ensure that the party that's not allowed to get benefit does not get benefit. As the Ram points out over here, it's obvious to the Gemara that if you set up the Mishnah as talking about a case where it's either merchandise that is very hot and easy to sell, or merchandise that's very difficult to sell, that it's clear what the outcome is in that case. And that the Mishnah must be talking about a case where it's at market price, but it's coming to teach you a number of items. Basically, through moving through this process, which is somewhat obvious, the Gemara shows you certain conclusions. And that is, in the case where it's a hot item, then the only benefiting party over there is the buyer if he buys it at market price. If it's a difficult object to sell, and it's sold at market price, then the seller is the sole beneficiary in that sale. In a case where it's shaveh b'shaveh, where it's a normal piece of inventory, and it's sold at market price, the Rashi notes that when we're doing a mitziah, it's actually sometimes the hana of the mocher, sometimes the hana of the lokeach, and that's the safek here. But the Ran himself says that it's actually then both parties, both the seller and the buyer, are beneficiaries over there, and that's basically the case of our Mishnah. Then what the Mishnah comes to teach us at that point is that even in a case of zvina harifa, even in a case where it's a hot item, if the seller is able to sell it above market price, then even in a case where it's a hot item, then the mocher, the seller, is the beneficiary and no longer is the buying party the beneficiary. Basically, what it's happening here is that the demand for the item, the fact that this item is in demand, has now moved the price up. And by moving the price up, you basically equalized the buyer's benefit of getting this hard-to-get merchandise, because now he's paying for that benefit, or he's paying for that privilege. Once he does that, then it becomes, or changes into the benefit of the seller. And the same is true in the reverse, that in an instance where it's a hard to sell object and the inventory is not moving, if the buyer gets a discount in that case, then you've reflected the fact that this inventory is hard to move in the price. Once you've done that, if the buyer pays less, then the buyer is the beneficiary and no longer is the seller the beneficiary. And that's what the Ram points out. All of this back and forth about the Mishnah is coming to teach us these items. That again, in a neutral case, a normal market price case, both parties are the beneficiaries. In a case where it's a market price and it's a really hot item, then the buyer is the beneficiary. If it's a market price and the seller is having a hard time getting this object to move, then it's his benefit if he gets it off at that price. But that can be neutralized by changing the price of the object. And therefore, if a person buys at a discount, even if it's a hard to move object, the buyer is the beneficiary. And the other way around, if very in demand item, if the seller then gets a higher price for it, then he is the beneficiary now and no longer is the buyer beneficiary. And that's what we've learned from this process of going through the Mishnah. On the other hand, Shmuel's statement that the buyer is the beneficiary is bizvina harifa, talking about inventory that is hard to get your hands on. In that case, the buyer is clearly the beneficiary. Since the buyer is the beneficiary, he is the one who's responsible when he takes it out for a test drive. So now, that hana'ah that he gets from the ability to test it out beforehand is a hana'ah that is solely belonging to the buyer. So the hana'ah is all to the buyer here. Number one, it's inventory that's hard to get your hands on. So the fact that the buyer gets it at all is a benefit for him. In addition to that, the fact that he gets to test drive it also gives him additional hana'ah, that he has the right to test it before he takes it, so that's also hana'ah to him. And in that instance, we say that since kol hana'ah shelo, all the hanas to the buyer and not to the seller over here, then he becomes the equivalent of a shoel, becomes the equivalent of a borrower. We know that there, mina Torah, there are arba'a shumrim. There are four different types of interactions that people can have with regards to an object. There's a shomer sachar, someone who's paid to watch an object. There's a shomer chinam, someone who watches an object without remuneration. And then you have a socher, someone who rents an object or utensil for monetary compensation. And then there's a shoel, somebody borrows an object without making any compensation for taking the object. Each one of these shomrim has different dinim as to the amount of responsibility they bear for the object that is in their possession. When it comes to shoel, we know that a shoel has full responsibility for the object. That means that no matter what happens to the object, the shoel, the borrower, is responsible for it. And the Gemara explains why. Because kol hana'a shelo, because he has all the benefit here. He doesn't pay for the object. He gets utility of the object, and then he gets to return it afterwards without having to pay and without any loss to him. So he gets all the benefit from the object. Since he gets all the benefit from the object, he's made most responsible for the object. The same is true over here. This person who's the buyer under Shmuel's case is completely the beneficiary over here. Number one, it's a hard to get item, and therefore when he gets to buy it at the market price, he's definitely the beneficiary. Number two, he's been given the right to test drive it. That's even better for him. Now he's test driving something that the mocher, the seller, never had to give him such an opportunity. He didn't have to give him that choice or ability to do that. The fact that he granted him that option, again, is to his benefit. So since all the benefit is accruing to him, he has a din like a shoel. And a shoel is chayav in kol ha'unsin. And that's what Shmuel says over here. Alokeach kli min ha'uman levokro v'ne'nas. Even if it's something that happened that was out of his control, it was an onus, nevertheless, chayav, he is responsible, just like the din of a shoel, that not only is chayav for geneva, vaveda, but it's also chayav for onsin. And that would be the case here as well, that the individual who's test driving it is responsible for anything that happens to it. The Gemara continues and says, Tanyo kavate de Shmuel. We have a bright thought that supports the position of Shmuel. Alokeach kelim min atagar l'shagran l'beit chamiv. An individual takes utensils, objects, really gifts, that he's sending to his father-in-law's house, but he is not taking possession of them, but he's sending them there on contingency. The Rosh notes over here that the Gemara says that he bought from a tagar, who is a professional seller, and that's what he does for a living, to tell you a chiddush, that even in that instance, the sole beneficiary is the lokeach, is the buyer here, and not the mocher whatsoever, despite the fact that that's what he does for a living. This is the way that he sells things, and he does things on consignment. Nevertheless, it's deemed to be hanat ha-lokeach, and that's why we consider him a shoel in this case. Im mikablim otam mimeni, if they accept the gifts, ani notein lecha d'mehem, then I will pay you for these gifts that you've given to me. V'im lav, ani notein lecha lefi tovat hana'ah shebehen. If they do not accept the gifts, then I will pay you what we'll call the benefit of saying that I gave a gift. I won't pay you for the actual value of the gift, but I'll pay you for the fact that I got to say that I gave them a gift, even though they didn't accept the gift. So there's some sort of notional value that is not the full value of the object, but the ability to say that I did something or that I gave the person the gift even though they rejected it. So now, in this instance, he's basically taking the inventory on consignment. He's saying, if I'm successful at granting the gift, then I'll pay you for it. If I'm not successful at granting the gift, then it's really yours, but I'll pay you basically a borrowing fee for the fact that you let me use this and grant it as a gift. So in that case, ne'entzu b'halicha, if there was a problem on the way to his father-in-law's house, chayav. In that instance, he's responsible. Bechazara, on the way back, he is patur. Then he becomes patur because b'nei shukunoseh sachar. Because on the way back, he's the equivalent of a shomer sachar. So on the way there, he is the beneficiary here of what's happening. It's the equivalent of someone taking it on a test drive in this instance, because that hana'ah, by which the seller is granting him the right to take it to his father-in-law's house, no matter what the outcome is. In this instance, he's going to be a beneficiary. Either he's the beneficiary because they accepted the gift, and therefore, basically, in the end, it's going to be his inventory, or he's a beneficiary even if they reject the gift because, in a sense, he is still getting the credit for granting the gift to his father-in-law. So since in that case, he is the nehene, kol hana'a shelo, all the benefit is now accruing to him, he is chayav for the own sin. On the other hand, on the way back home means that the father-in-law rejected the gift. Because if he's coming home with the gift, that means that he rejected it. At this point, who does the object really belong to? In a sense, the inventory has been returned to the seller because he didn't successfully sell it in this consignment, and therefore it now returns to the possession of the seller. The only problem is that it's not in the hands of the seller right now. So since it's not in the hands of the seller right now, he is responsible to return it to the seller. He's acting, in a sense, as a shliach or a shomer of the seller to bring him back the inventory. What type of shomer is he? He's a shomer sachar. He is a shomer sachar at this point because he's getting, in a sense, payment or benefit from the fact that he was able to grant the gift, even though it was rejected. He also owes, in a sense, the tovat hana'ah that he had promised the individual. And therefore, he's deemed to be a shomer sachar on the return trip. Now, that means the din of a shomer sachar is that he's chayav b'gneva v'avida. He's responsible for theft and for loss, but he's not responsible for onus. He's not responsible for things that are out of his control, things that he couldn't have prevented. On the other hand, if he's a shoel, if he's considered to be a borrower, where kol hana'ah shelo, then not only is he responsible for gneva v'avida, but he's also responsible for onus. Therefore, on the way there, he is deemed to be a shoel, because kol hana'ah shelo, since all of it is his hana'ah, he is deemed to be a shoel, and in that instance, he's going to be chayab for any outcome or any problem that arises with the object. On the way home, since he's gotten whatever benefit he's going to get, he's done with, because the father-in-law rejected the gift. At this point, he's just responsible to get the gift back to the original seller. So that, he's deemed to be a shomer sachar. As being a shomer sachar, he is chayav in gneva v'avida, but he's patur mionis. And because of that, if something happens that was out of his control on the way back, he would be patur. And that's what the Braita says over here, that on the way there, he's chayav for onus. On the way back, he is patur for onus. And this is very similar to the din of Shmuel, which says that when you are the person who's getting all the benefit, in that instance, you become the responsible party for the object, which is similar to the din in general of a shoel, which is that as long as the person is a borrower, then kol hana'ah shelo, and he's fully responsible. Once the yemei sheila, once the time period of borrowing expires, then the shoel turns into a shomer sachar, and he now becomes a responsible party, return the object to the person who lent it to him. So in that case, he becomes a shomer sachar, and similarly over here. And the reason being, doho v'nehne mehane, umuchach lahata meach breite, the kevin debalicha v'shoel b'chazra mi'ini, delo avi shoel shomer sachar havi, where he turns or converts into a noseh sachar, into a shomer sachar, after the expiration of the time of the she'ela. Then so too this individual over here, on the way there, is deemed to be a shoel, and therefore on the way back, he's deemed to be a shomer sachar. Because of the benefit that he got along the way as a shoel, that's what makes him or deems him a shomer sachar now for providing the protection of the return of the item to its owner. And that's what makes him into a shomer sachar over here. Whereas there are other Rishonim who believe that the reason he's a Shomer Sachar over here is because of the Hana'ah that the owner of the merchandise gave him permission to take it without the obligation to buy it. That's the Hana'ah that makes him into a Shomer Sachar. How Safsira? The Shoko Chamra Lizvune. So here, a Safsira is basically a middleman, someone who is a wholesale transactor. He buys and sells objects at the wholesale level. He's trading in objects. So he shakol chamra lizvune. He took a donkey in order to sell it. Lo izavin. and he was not successful at doing this. So instead of buying it and taking possession of it and then selling it where he's carrying the inventory risk, rather he took it on consignment and said, listen, I'll try to sell it on your behalf. If I'm successful, then I will give you a portion of the money and I'll keep a portion for myself. If I'm not successful, then I'm going to return the object to you. So he never takes possession of the chamor. So now, Bahadei de Hadar, on the return trip, after he was unsuccessful at selling the chamor, idnis chamra, something went on with the chamor that was an ones, and chayevei Rav Nachman lishlume. Rav Nachman obligated him to pay. Now, based on what we know from Shmuel, that seems like a strange psak halacha by Rav Nachman. Because according to Shmuel, on the way to selling the chamor, he might have been deemed a shoel. On the way home, at best, he's deemed to be a shomer tzachar. He's a shomer tzachar in returning the chamor to its original owner, to the seller over here. Then he should be deemed a shomer tzachar. He's chayav in gneva v'aveda, but he's not chayav in ones. If that's the case, why is Rav Nachman obligating him to pay in a case of ones on the return trip? And that's what Rova says. Eid ve'rova the Rav Nachman nensu ba'alicha chayav b'chazara patur. How come you paskin that they are chayav? Amalei chazara de safsira holachahi. When it comes to a middleman or this individual who sells on consignment, then there is no going and coming. He sees every person that he bumps into as a potential buyer. Doesn't mean if he's on the way to trying to sell it, on the way back from selling it, he's always selling. That's what he does for a living. He sells. He's a salesperson. So anytime he bumps into somebody, whether he's on the way back, that is a potential for him to sell. And therefore, at all points, he's considered to be bahalicha. He's always on his way to selling because there's never a point where he wouldn't sell it. Dilo mishkach lizvune, afilu above a debate. If he finds a guy that's willing to buy it, even at the doorstep of the house, milo mizavinle, wouldn't he sell it at that point? So unlike the case by the father-in-law, where once the father-in-law rejects the gift, then the individual has no intention to buy it at that point. He's returning it to him because, in a sense, the sheila, the borrowing period, is over. Since the borrowing period is over, then the hana'ah switches from being kol hana'ah of the buyer to him flipping into being a shomer tzachar in terms of protecting the object on the way back because of the hana'ah that he got on the way there. But that's because there's a clear delineation at which point there's a shift between it being all the benefit to the buyer versus the benefit really now coming to the mocher, in the sense that the buyer is protecting the object to get it back to the mocher. That's clear by the case of the father-in-law. In our instance over here with the safsira, there is no clear delineation where he stops being someone who's trying to sell the chamor into somebody who's just trying to return the object. Since he, at any moment, is willing to sell it, and there's no point to which he says, I don't sell it anymore, I'm just going to give it back to him, until he actually hands it back to him. Therefore, at all points, he's considered to be a borrower along the way, and therefore, kol hana'ah shelo, he's responsible for the object at that point in time. So therefore, the Gemara here concludes, with regards to this din of Shmuel, that whenever a buyer is the sole beneficiary of holding on to the object, or having the inventory in his possession, then he's deemed to be a shoel, even though he's yet to buy it, and he's yet to have paid for it. Technically, it's not his until he pays for it. It's really still in the possession of the mocher. But because all the benefit comes to him, he's deemed to be a shoel during that period of time before he actually purchases it. And that's the same as the person taking the car out for the test drive. And that's the same for the individual who takes the object on consignment in order to give it as a gift to his father-in-law. In either of these cases, he is the sole beneficiary along the way, and therefore he becomes like a shoel. At the point that he buys it, then it goes into his possession. But at that point, by the case of the test drive of the car, it's his car then. In the case of the gift, it's now gifted to his father-in-law, and he's paying for it. It's his that he gave to his father-in-law. In either of those instances, if already he has made a decision that he will buy it, he's done with the part of being a shoel, then at that point, he now just becomes responsible to return the object to the individual who owns it, to the mocher. In that case, he's a shomer tzachar from the benefit that he already got from being a shoel up front. That makes him into a shomer tzachar on the return. But that's assuming that there's a clear delineation at which point he stops being a shoel and turns into a shomer tzachar, at a point in which there's a clear decision. Either he is going to buy it or he's not going to buy it. That makes or changes him from a shoel to a shomer tzachar. In an instance where it's never clear where that delineation point is, he remains a shoel until he returns it to the hands of the seller. And that's the story with regards to the safsira. So if Sira remains a Shoel until he actually hands it back into the hands of the seller. All right, now the next Mishnah says, Kunam Shani Nere Le Arelim Mutar Barele Yisrael Vasur Bemule Ovde Kochavim. So this is something that we discussed in other instances or other situations, which is, if a person says, I will get no benefit from anybody who is an Arel, then the word Arel, even though it means anybody who's uncircumcised, anybody who does not have a Brit Milah, nevertheless, in the vernacular, when you talk about Arelim, you're not talking about literally people who do not or do have a Brit Milah. You're simply talking about the distinction between a nation that generally has a Brit Milah versus a nation that does not generally have a Brit Milah or is commanded in Brit Milah. And therefore, when he means that I will not get benefit from those that are Arelim, he refers to anybody besides Klal Yisrael. That means that Arle Klal Yisrael are not included in his neder, because his neder references non-Jews. It's not referring to Jews, even though these Jews happen not to have a Brit Milah and they are Arelim. Nevertheless, that's not what is meant by the term Arel. There's actually a machloket amongst the Rishonim as to whether this is limited to solely someone who does not get a Milah because of Ones, meaning that his brothers died from a Milah and therefore we're not giving a Milah, or whether this is even for someone who doesn't get a Milah bizadon, intentionally. From Rashi over here, it sounds like that it's all to do with an issue of someone who didn't get a Milah because they were Ne'nas, whereas the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah makes it sound like anybody who's Mutsuvet ala Milah is considered or deemed to be Mule Yisrael, and therefore even someone who didn't get a Milah bizadon would still be under this category of Mule Yisrael, because he is mitzuvah in the milah. And the same is true in the reverse. If you have an Ovde Kochavim that has a Brit Milah, that does not make him into a non-Arel. Because Arel is a terminology that's used to refer to anybody who's not part of Klal Yisrael. Shani ne'aneh demulim. If he says it in the other way, which he says, I will get no benefit from someone who is circumcised, asur ba'arele Yisrael, he still may not get benefit from someone who is uncircumcised in Klal Yisrael. Umutar b'molei Ovdei Kochavim, and he is permitted to get benefit from someone who is a non-Jew who is circumcised. She'ein orla kruya el l'shem Ovdei Kochavim. As the Mishnah states over here, basically what we've been saying until this point is that the word Arel is not synonymous with uncircumcised, but rather is synonymous with non-Jew. She'nemar ki kol ha'goyim arelim v'chol beit Yisrael arelev. So here you see that the term Arelim references anybody who is a Goy, anybody who is not amongst Klal Yisrael. And Klal Yisrael themselves are only called Arelev, but not Arelim. So the term Arelim references to anybody who is a non-Jew. And if that's the case, it's irrespective of the personal status of the individual. Whether he is circumcised or uncircumcised is irrelevant over here, because the word Arel means anybody who is a non-Jew. Vomer. Vaya plishti harel hazeh. So again, that plishti harel hazeh, that reference to the plishti as an harel, who says that the plishti was uncircumcised? How do you know? They weren't checking whether he was circumcised or uncircumcised. It very well might have been that he was circumcised. When David calls Goliath an harel, he doesn't know whether he really is an harel or not an harel. He just termed him an harel because that was a general terminology that was used for a plishti. Because the terminology harel is used to reference to anybody who is not a Jew. Vomer, pen tismachno b'not plishtim, pen talozna b'not ha'irelim. So there they say, maybe the b'not plishtim will celebrate, or maybe they will rejoice, the daughters of the Arelim. Again, they're referencing the plishtim as being Arelim, even though there's no certainty as to whether they have a Brit Milah or don't have a Brit Milah. They're not checking out to see if every individual does or does not have a Brit Milah. And truthfully, over here, we're talking about women in this case, where it's not even relevant to speak about Brit Milah, and nevertheless, they're termed as Arelim. They're considered to be Arelim. They're considered to be non-Jews in this instance. As to why we bring three different proofs to this fact over here, the Ran says over here, had we just had the first Pasuk that talks about Arelev, then you might have thought that the Arelim in the beginning of the Pasuk that refers to the Goyim is being modified by the Arelev at the second half of the Pasuk, and the meaning of the word Arel there is not Arel Basar, but rather Arel Lev. That's why it brings the second proof. V'omer, v'ya plishti Arel hazeh. and he calls him an Arel, even though he doesn't know whether he is an Arel or he was Nolad Mahul. And if you say, listen, being born Mahul is not really a common occurrence, then that's no proof as to why he called him an Arel over here. So then we have the third proof for you, which is Pentalozna Benotai Reilim. And how could you call the whole nation of Plishtim without knowing whether there was someone who had a Milah or someone who was born with a Milah? And that's why we have that third Pasuk to teach us that part of the Chidush. Or the Marashah gives a different Srichuta, which is in the first case you talk about a whole nation in the plural. The second Pasuk teaches us that it even applies by a single individual like Goliath, where he calls him an Arel. And the third Pasuk tells us that it even has application by women who have no Shechut, Arelut, or Milah. Still, the word Arel references to the women. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah Omer, Mu'usahi ho'orla shnitganu by Rishayim. The Orla is considered to be something that is so disgusting, unwanted, unpleasant, that the Rishayim are denigrated by being referred to as Arelim. Shneamar, ki kol ha'goyim Arelim. That all the nations are deemed to be or considered to be Arelim. That's obviously not a positive statement. That is, in a sense, a negative statement of denigration. Rabbi Shmuel Omer, Gedula Milah, Shenichrutu Aleha, 13 Britot. Rabbi Shmuel says the Milah is tremendous, or so great, because it has 13 covenants that were said about it. Now, the 13 covenants are the fact that the word Brit in the Parsha of Brit Milah with regards to Avram Avinu is mentioned 13 times. And based on that, the din of Brit Milah, many times the Gemara talks about Brit Milah not being able to have limud or extrapolation from the dinim of Brit Milah, because Brit Milah has a chumrah or a special side to it, which is that it was nichrutu aleha 13 britot. Yossi Omer, gedola milah shutuchat haShabbat. You know how great the milah is? That it overrides the Shabbat, hachamura. It overrides Shabbat, which is considered to be one of the primary mitzvot of our faith, and nevertheless, milah is able to override it. That tells you how significant Brit Milah is, how significant the covenant of Milah is, if it has the ability to override Shabbat, which is one of the fundamentals of our belief. Yeshua ben Karcho Omer, Gudala Milah, Shalom Nitla Moshe Tzadik Aleha, Melo Sha'a. Milah is so great that even Moshe Rabbeinu was not spared from punishment because he tarried in giving the Brit Milah, which the Gemara will address, that the Parsha in the beginning of Shmot, when he is traveling back to Mitzrayim, and he stops at the Malon, he stops at the hotel in order to stay over and to take care of his needs, the fact that he didn't give a Brit Milah has the Nachash that comes and then swallows him up, and then Tzipora has to give a Brit Milah to their son in order to protect Moshe Rabbeinu, but Moshe Rabbeinu is taken to task for the fact that he didn't give a Brit Milah to his son right away. The Gersa that Rashi has over here, Shekol Zichuyotav Shemoshe Lo Amdu Lo, that none of the merits of Moshe Rabbeinu stood for him in the moment where he was Nitrashel Min Amilah, where he was found deficient or lacking in alacrity in taking care of the mitzvah of Milah. None of his merits withstood that issue, and he was held accountable for it. That tells you how significant the mitzvah Brit Milah is, that Moshe was taken to task over it. Nechemiah Omer, Gedola Milah, Shutuchat HaNigayim. The Milah is so great that even though there's a law in the Torah for one to remove a nega from their body, Yishar Melecha, that you're not allowed to take off a nega or remove a nega, nevertheless, if it's in the context of giving a Brit Milah, it is able to override, and if you have to give a Brit Milah, and by giving that Brit Milah, you're also going to cut off a nega, that is permitted. And it could be that the Mishnah brings this down over here, even though once it's Doche Shabbat, what's the big deal that a Milah is Doche Negaim? It's because the source for the fact that Milah is Doche Shabbat comes through a limud with regards to the mitzvah of Negaim. Rabbi Omer, Gedula Milash, Kol Mitzvot Shas Avram Avinu, Lo Nikra Shalem Ad Shemal. That all the things that Avram Avinu did, said, and acted on, none of those brought him to the point of Shlemut until he got a Milah. Shenemar, Hitalech Lefanai Veyet Tamim. When was he called Tamim? That was only after he had gotten a Brit Milah. Devar Acher, Gedula Milah. The Milah is so great, Shimalei Hi Lo Vara Kodesh Baruch Hu Alumo. Hashem would not have created the world had it not been for the mitzvah Milah. Shneamar, Komar Hashem, Imlo Briti, Yomam Valaila, Hukot Shemai Varetz, Lo Samti. If it was not for my covenant of day and night, the laws of nature of Shemai Varetz, Lo Samti, I wouldn't put into place. So, you see here, what's the Brit, what's the covenant that's there day and night? That's the Brit Milah. For it weren't for the covenant of the Brit Milah, Hashem would have not put Chukot Shemayim Varetz in place. And there you see the correlation or connection between Maseh Breishit, the creation of the world, and the mitzvah of Brit Milah. As you can see here in the Masoret HaShatz, in the Ein Yaakov, there's an additional line here in the Mishnah, which is, Rabbi Omer, Gdula Milah Shishkula Kenet Kol HaMitzvot. That Milah is so great because it's equated to all the mitzvot, Shenemar. So now the explanation of that, you can see here in the Balei HaTosafot, say, Afagav de Pashtek de Krob Hartzat Damim Bedam Shnatan Moshe Betz Ba'o Mishtaye. Over there, when we're talking about the Dam Brit that we said Asher Karat, that Dam Brit that is being quoted over there is not the Dam of Milah, but rather the Dam of the Korbanot, or that which Moshe sprinkles with his finger on the individual. Mekom Makom Mukilei Nami Bedam Milah. They do include in that dam milah, kishe nichnasim lebrit. Mukila nami b'dam milah, kishe nichnasim lebrit. Because over there they're entering into the covenant. And when they entered into the covenant, how did they enter into a covenant with the Kodesh Baruch Hu? One of those things is dam milah, kare dam brit. How do they enter the covenant with the Kodesh Baruch Hu? Through milah, tvilah, vartzat damim. So therefore we see that dam milah is also called dam brit. Because it says in the Pasuk, in Shmot Chavdalit, Hinei Dam Abrit. So therefore, Milah is included under this term of Dam or Dam Brit. And that's what's meant that it's Shkula Keneged Kol HaMitzvot. Because it's the thing or the item that entered us into the covenant with the Kodesh Baruch Hu to accept the Torah. The Iran has a similar but slightly different formulation. It says, Shenemer Hinei Dam Brit, V'avagav Dai Dam Lav Dam Milahu. When it comes to the Torah as a whole, k'tiv brit, the word covenant is used. Ubi milah nami k'tiv brit, and by milah there's also the term covenant is used. Mitzvatash kula keneged kol mitzvot. It's almost like an agadic gezer shava of brit. Since the terminology of covenant is used with regards to the whole Torah, it's also used with regards to brit milah. There's an equation that equates the two here that they're both on a par level. They're on equal level, equal footing, which is that the Brit Milah is Keneged Kol HaTorah Kula. So that's the way the Ran learns it. On the other hand, Tosafot sees it as part of their entering into the covenant to be Mekayim the Torah. One of those vehicles for entering into the covenant is the Dam of the Brit Milah. So the Dam of the Brit Milah, in a sense, is what generates the covenant between us and Kodesh Baruch Hu. And it's Kula, it's equal to Kol HaMitzvot Sheba Torah. All right, we'll stop here at the end of the Mishnah because the Gemara over here is going to discuss the issue that we mentioned in the Mishnah with regards to the fact that Moshe was held accountable for not giving the Brit Milah on time. So since it continues into tomorrow's daf, we'll stop over here and we'll continue with that sugya tomorrow at the Gemara on the bottom of Lamed Aleph Amid Bet.